one of the major questions that is raised constantly is, what is this great reset, and what does this have to do with each of us as individuals, or we as a collective society? And does this have anything to do with the way we have interpreted or used capitalism with a large C over the past 150 years or so? And how does all this tie into the pandemic? To unwrap all this is Professor Richard Wolff. He is Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts and currently a visiting professor at New York City's New School University Graduate Program in International Affairs. His focus has been on the history of economic crisis, the Marxian economic theory, and class and worker struggles. In the past, he's taught at Yale and the University of Paris. He holds degrees in economics and history from Harvard, Stanford, and Yale universities. And he has authored over 20 books. His latest is The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Professor Wolff hosts the syndicated program Economic Update, which can be heard every Saturday at 12:30 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be here.
There are two main issues I hope we can address in depth. First is the state of the economy under the pandemic and the likely trajectory it may take. Second, since early this past summer, we've been seeing an increasing number of articles and commentaries about the Great Reset, or the Fourth Industrial Revolution, being strategized by the World Economic Forum. That most people have never heard of the World Economic Forum, the average, you know, working class person, but it has a lot of corporate allies. And we will definitely be seeing more of this. It's gaining some attention during the coming months and years after the forum holds its annual meeting at Davos next year. A prime directive of the Great Reset Project is to re-envision our economic regime. But first, during the months after the coronavirus reached our shores, there has been a systemic collapse in many of our economic and social sectors. It has terribly victimized workers and small business owners. Last Sunday, The Hill reported on a study that found that one-third of all of New Jersey's small businesses have had to close permanently. Now, I'm not aware of how many small businesses exist in New Jersey, but clearly as one of the largest, most populated states, that's a lot of businesses. Tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of employees had to find other work or can't find work. There's also been a criminal negligence of the federal government in most states to protect the most vulnerable who can't make it in their rent payments, buy food, medicines, or the means to homeschool while schools are in lockdown. Tens of millions have lost their jobs, and most of those jobs will not return or will return where it's been handicapped against the worker. So please take your time and share your perceptions and analysis of the current state of our economy, and based upon the government's response so far, or the lack thereof, do you have a larger prognosis for where the economy seems to be headed, not just under Trump, but also under the new Biden administration? The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So let me start with the condition of the American economy today. And let me start with a story. I am proudly and happily a left-wing economist, and my colleagues in the profession include people who are right-wing economists and folks in the center and so on. We do not agree on how we got into the current situation of our economy here in the United States, and we do not agree on how to get out of the situation. But here's something we agree on, and we were all surprised to find ourselves in this kind of agreement. And when I say ourselves, I mean my fellow economists, the people that I associate with. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life. These are the folks I went to school with. My classmate at Yale, where I got my PhD, was Janet Yellen, who used to be the head of the Federal Reserve and is now slated to be the Secretary of the Treasury under the new Biden administration. These are the folks I know. We agree that this is the worst condition of the American economic system in our lifetimes. I cannot overstate how serious the crisis is that we are going through. We are in some ways even worse off now than the last time that the capitalist system utterly crashed, which was the Great Depression of the 1930s. It's worse now because the unemployment soared up to the level of the Great Depression in a matter of weeks, whereas in the 1930s, it took a matter of years. And that gave people a chance, not that they did well, but a chance to try to acclimatize, to prepare themselves. You had nothing of that here. Here's another difference. We went through the crash of 1929, by the way, which lasted until 1941. We went through that without simultaneously going through a public health disaster. By contrast, we are now going through simultaneously the worst crash in capitalism in a century and the worst viral pandemic in a century. The last one was the 1918 so-called Spanish flu. And we've had viruses since then, but nothing as destructive as that one then or the COVID-19 now. Going through either an economic crash or a public health catastrophe would be a challenge to a system. Having to go through them both at the same time literally has no parallel that I could point anyone to. And so it is, I want to stress all of this to get folks to understand not to pay attention to the efforts, for example, of the Trump administration and its spokespeople to somehow make light, whether it's of the virus or of the economic downturn, to imagine that it is somehow fleeting or temporary or minor. It is none of those things. Unfortunately, a good number of people on the other side of the political spectrum, the left, whether it's the Democratic Party or even further, seems also, and maybe it's just wishful thinking, to imagine that this is a problem we can overcome with this or that legal change or regulatory change or commitment, whether it's specific to do this or that, or the more general. And that's what I'm going to talk about in a moment about this, the Great Reset, which is a more general response. None of these things are really serious. This is not a way to cope with something as profound as what we are going through. And when you remember, as we need to, that on top of this combination of economic crash and pandemic, viral pandemic, we have a number of problems that have been building up in our capitalist system and have not been resolved, have been, as people say, kicked down the road in the hopes that somehow the problem will solve itself or will go away. And two that I'll pick out, and there are more than these two, but two that I'll pick out is the global warming climate issue and all of the environmental problems we face as a society with all of their impacts on our health, as you are famous for documenting, among others, mental health, physical health, all the rest. And then there's the racial problem that exploded over the last 2 or 3 years to remind us that that has not been anywhere near adequately solved. It's too much. But the first step in getting out of a disaster is to at least face honestly that you're in one. Now to the specifics. It has been so hard for so many people in America to cope since March. that, for example, most states in the United States and the federal government, Centers for Disease Control, have ordered a ban on evictions. And here's what that means. Tens of millions of American families have been unable and have, in fact, not paid rents on their apartments for months. On top of that, tens of thousands of businesses, like those in New Jersey that you referred to, they have also not paid rent in the malls where their businesses are located, in the buildings in urban areas where they're located. These rents have not disappeared. They have not been canceled. They have been accumulating and have been added to with penalties and interest charges. They now loom to the impossibility of these small businesses and these millions of families. At the end of this month, December 31st, 2020, these moratoria on evictions in most cases lapse. No one knows what is going to happen here. No one understands that the possibility exists. And with each passing day, the possibility gets closer to becoming a probability that we are going to turn millions of men, women, and children into the streets to add to the already serious homelessness problem, at the same time that we preach to people that safety and health require you to social distance, to wash your hands, to stay indoors, to avoid interactions with people who may be ill, etc. I mean, the torturous inconsistency and contradiction here really is astonishing. If you look at the most recent statement by Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, he seems to be unwilling to have any kind of relief program, massive government relief. And it would have to be massive, larger than anything we have ever done, because our problems, as I hope I've been able to explain, are deeper and bigger and wider than ever. Last couple of points on the condition. One of the great victims, totally unnecessary, but one of the great victimizations we have gone through this year has been denying education to an enormous proportion, more than half, of our young people. Let me explain what I mean. I'm not just talking about the schools that literally closed their doors. I'm not just speaking about them, although that's part of the problem. I'm talking about the millions of people who cannot, for a whole host of reasons, access computers to participate in so-called distance learning or internet learning or online learning. I'm a professor. I do this for a living. You cannot teach with a computer what you could do in the classroom. It's not even close. If you add that young people going to school have other demands on their attention, can often be part of a family which has multiple young people, but not an equivalent number of computers. If you remember that computers have glitches and need experts to help solve them so that they can be used, none of this is generally available. As usual, the richest amongst us can quickly get private supports, computers, computer specialists, classes, tutors, you name it. But for the vast majority of working people and poor people, they are being denied the education that was one of the few ways they could hope to escape all the negativity of poverty in our society. We are going to be for generations living with the consequences of interrupted or ended educations of our people. By the way, recent statistics indicate that a growing number of young people have completely dropped out of school. It's not just that they don't go to classes anymore, even where they are held, but that they don't participate in the distance learning whatsoever. They are literally dropping out of the society that takes us as young people to school to prepare us as adults for the work situation. So I wish I didn't have to say this to you or to your audience, Gary, but the crisis, the economic and public health crises feeding each other right now are a disaster. And if you allow me, I have to say, because I'm a critic of capitalism, I have to say something that I know will sound a little bit like the proverbial, I told you so. But the reality is that it is our economic system that rendered us so horribly unprepared. You know better than I. Viruses are part of the human condition, of the world of the animals, and the world of the plants, for that matter, have been with us since time immemorial. We know what the Spanish flu did in this country back in 1918. We know more recently about SARS and MERS and Ebola and a whole host of others. There is and was no excuse for being unprepared, for not having stockpiles around the United States of masks, of gloves, of ventilators, of beds and hospital units and trained personnel. It was only a matter of time before the next virus hit, and we should have and we could have been prepared, but we weren't. The masks were not produced by private capitalist enterprises that are capable of doing it. They weren't stored in warehouses around the country where the populations exist. They weren't, in short, made available. And there is no excuse. And there's no excuse for the government having not stepped in to compensate. And you know the reason why companies didn't produce the masks? They weren't profitable. And I understand that. It isn't profitable to produce a mask, to stick it in a warehouse somewhere, to monitor it, to guard it, to clean it, to repair it if it breaks, to replace it if it wears out, while you wait an indeterminate number of years until the next virus comes. That's the problem. Public health, one of the most important demands we put on our economic system, cannot be handled by a for-profit economic engine. Capitalism and public health don't go together. But we don't face that. We can't. We are ideologically committed to capitalism no matter what it does to us. And now it is literally killing us, and our government, enthralled to private enterprise and capitalism, couldn't and didn't step in. And if I had a lot more time, I would tell you the same story in terms of the economic crash. Capitalism has an economic downturn. Over the last three centuries, on average, every 4 to 7 years, in every country where it has settled, that's the average. Let me give you one illustration. We are 20 years into this new century. We had the so-called dot-com crisis in the spring of 2000. We had the so-called subprime mortgage crisis in the autumn of 2008. And here we are with the COVID-19 so-called crisis in 2020. 20 years, three crises, that's on average a little under seven, right on schedule. We haven't overcome them. Capitalism hasn't figured out how to stop it. We would have had a crash with or without COVID, but we have now capitalism's worst nightmare, a crash of the economic system happening in the same time and place as a catastrophe in public health. And our economic system fail to protect us from either one of them, let alone the combination. And my own opinion is those who understand what I've just said, like the folks at the World Economic Forum, are desperate to figure out how they can save a capitalist system that works so poorly, that costs us so dearly. And that some of them remember their history, that in the 13th and 14th century, European feudalism was decimated by a bacterial pandemic, the so-called Black Death, carried by lice and rats, that killed a third of the European population. Feudalism never recovered. And my suspicion, and that of others, capitalism will not recover. And the World Economic Forum, which is a collection, as you rightly said, of big business, they're talking about a new kind of capitalism, or a resetting of capitalism, or a capitalism that is more attentive to social needs or environmental concerns. We've heard this for a long time. Capitalism is a system that has its own logic, its own pressures, its own mechanisms. It has brought us to an impasse, and clever phraseology repeated by politicians looking to make some points isn't going to solve our problem.
I really appreciate that overview. Thank you very much, Richard. Richard, I'm going to pose three interlocking issues with you that are almost never discussed, and see if this makes sense to you, because this has bothered me for a long time. I remember back in the early 1970s when we started to see green mailing, in effect buying stock in companies and then blackmailing the company that you're going to take over their board if they didn't give you a check and you walked away, and they did. But then they started buying companies, downsizing them, and taking the brand, just the brand, off to China, Mexico, India, Bangladesh. And within a period of 20 years, a substantial part of what we made, Americans made, and made under union labor where they had collective bargaining and their interests were protected, that was decimated. And it didn't matter whether the president was Ronald Reagan or Gerald Ford or George Bush or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. This has gone on nonstop, no matter what they say about bringing jobs back. They really gutted America's labor force, the working class. And that's one issue. Why aren't the media covering that, of who was responsible for doing that, instead of praising the equity partners and the Apollo group and the Kravitz group of equity partners, when all that's left after they do something, including Mitt Romney's group, are a lot of lost jobs, and more often than not, taking what is valuable, the brand, manufacturing it elsewhere, and those jobs never come back, and we end up with empty areas, and we see it in Newark and Detroit, and I filmed in these places for the special on Poverty Inca, the documentary. That's one thing. Nobody's ever held accountable for the economic, what I call economic genocide, that has occurred. In fact, to the contrary, everyone now who is coming out, or not everyone, but most people coming out of school with an MBA are looking to go down to Wall Street or some other place to get a part of the pie for themselves. They don't look at the ethics. They don't look at the morality of how they made their money. Why isn't the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN, the so-called liberal people in the media, why aren't they covering this? Instead, they've actually glorified this. That's number one. Number two is that I've written extensively with detailed instructions of how to take the number one expense in America, our healthcare system, which is about $3.5 trillion, and to take the profit out of it, to leave 100% markup. That's more than enough compared to any other business. And if you left 100% markup, then that means that the average person could afford to be sick without going bankrupt. But I wanted to see if universal healthcare, which could be done under Medicare. And Richard Gell and I spent 2 months and we did the math. We could actually go from $3.5 trillion debt each year for healthcare to $1 trillion, saving $2.5 trillion if we took the excess profit out of all of medicine and provided universal healthcare. And yet when I sent this over to Representative Cortez and all the different people, nobody would respond. Here was a blueprint. with details, real scholarship. And in fact, to give them examples, I took the top 10 leading medications in the United States and showed that there was anywhere from a 3,000 to 150,000% markup between the 30-day generic bottle, like a 7 cents, 12 cents to make a 30 capsules or tablets and of a drug versus hundreds of dollars for the actual finished product. Okay. No response. Why cost to go in for a stomach ache in an emergency room and get nothing more than a saline solution, which cost $1, and they charged $1,000 for the saline solution and $9,000 for the person going to an emergency room? No bed, no treatment. And I actually got the bill on that from one of my friends, and how you could change all that. But it seems like everyone talks about wanting people to be healthy, and yet there's no real changing of the system. The same is true for my third thing. When it comes to COVID, yes, it's a real virus. Yes, it kills people. That's without question. But something that saves people is a drug called hydroxychloroquine taken with azithromycin, an antibiotic, and zinc. And actually, the powerful part of that is actually the zinc. And yet, if you read the medical literature, and this is very important now, they would say, no, don't take it. It's bad. It doesn't work. It kills people. In point of fact, they said there was no study supporting it. I found 177 studies in the peer-reviewed literature, or 177 studies, 122 in the peer-reviewed literature. And just a week ago in the Senate, three very courageous doctors, we're talking about Harvard professor and cardiologist of 50 years, and they all said the same thing, including from your former alma mater, Yale, the top epidemiologist, Dr. Roche over there, said, In all my decades of being a scientist, and he's an MD, PhD, 300 published articles, he said, I've never seen a drug this safe and this effective, and yet no one's allowed to get it in the United States. Why? Because of profit. Because they want you to take a very expensive $3,000 drug, $3,200, for a drug that the World Health Organization has now came out with last week and said, doesn't work, don't use it. And yet it's still being promoted and still being used. And it doesn't work, and yet hydroxychloroquine in combination cost about 47 cents to manufacture. It's under $200 for a whole treatment. It does work. So they're sacrificing at least 100,000 people who could have gotten it in the first 7 days would be alive today, according to these scientists and medical doctors. And yet the media won't touch it. No one will touch the story of what's good about a drug that is off patent. Anybody can use it, FDA approved. Been used billions of, over 4 billion times it's been used in 65 years, and yet they won't use something inexpensive that is effective and non-toxic. They want you to do an experimental drug that's never been used, that's very expensive, and their clinical study show it doesn't use. Does that align with your concept of how they have, capitalism has to take everything and profit from it, even though there could be natural or not natural remedies, even a drug like hydroxychloroquine is one example, and they denied even attack it. Your thoughts on these three different principles?
Well, yes, I'm going to give you the short answer is yes, the problem is capitalism, but I know that I need to explain that. So in the time that I have, let me try quickly to address each of the points you made. First, the export of jobs, the closing of factories and stores and offices here and reopening them in other countries or expanding into other countries, something that has been going on literally without stop for at least the last 40 years on a massive scale. The answer there is very, very simple. This is done because it's more profitable to go elsewhere than to go here. Think of it this way, and pardon me for the irony and the sarcasm, but it's the only way I can cope with having to tell this story. Workers in America struggled for 150 years. They built trade unions, they fought, and they got laws, and they got wages that were decent enough to have a home, to have an automobile, to maybe even dream of sending their kids to college. In order to pay for those things, they pushed their wages up. Corporations did very well. That's why capitalism has been successful in this country. But they had to share at least some of the hard work and the profitability and the productivity of their workers with those workers. And that meant that by the 1970s, because that's when it really shifted, they noticed something. They're not stupid. They noticed that the wages they paid to their American workers were many times better, higher than the wages earned by poor people in India or China or Brazil at that time. And because of the development of the jet engine and because of the development of modern telecommunications, they began to have what you might call their eureka moment. They realized they could produce in China, in India, in Brazil, paying a fraction, a small fraction of the wages, and therefore pocket the difference as more profits. Capitalism is a system in which capitalists compete over who can make the most profit, because the more profit you have, the better able you are to survive in the competition. It's the way the system is set up. So companies with courage moved out of the country, US, to take advantage of cheap labor, low wages elsewhere. And when they figured out how to do it, and when they were successful, and when their profits zoomed up, all the other companies that had hesitated, had decided, I don't want to do that, I want to be, I don't know, patriotic, they had to go, or else they would have been competed out of existence. And we've lived with it since. Those capitalists had to move, even if they understood that closing down their factories or their offices in the United States would decimate communities, would wipe out working class neighborhoods and families. Even if they had a decent human feeling about it, their competitive survival in the capitalist system left them no choice, and they left. That's the reality that we are living with. As long as we allow a system to be guided and governed and shaped by the profit calculations of the business community, and remember, businessmen, employers, are a tiny minority in our society. The vast majority of us are employees. We are excluded from knowing what the profits are, let alone deciding how to maximize them, how to react to competition. That's all done by that minority. They left the United States. They abandoned the United States economically, and we're living with the results. If you don't like the results, you know, I was born in the city of Youngstown, Ohio. It's a ghost town. It was once a thriving center of steel production here in the United States, but now it's a place where you go and stare at empty factories. All the damage done to decades of people in Ohio was none of the concern of those capitalists. They moved production to Brazil or wherever they went, made more money, boomed in the stock market, developed enormous wealth. And what happened to all of us, my family and the others who were steel workers, was of no concern. They could care less. That's the way our system works. And if you don't like those results, and I surely don't, and I think most Americans don't, well, then you've got to confront the system. Let me turn next to the price of drugs and all of those issues that you raised so poignantly. Look, I'm an economist. I'm going to give you the economist answer. The health industries in this country are divided, by economists anyway, into four basic different industries. Doctors is one. Hospitals is two. Drug and device makers is three. And health insurers is four. Four different industries. What they have done, and done very successfully, is to get together to operate a monopoly. It ought to be called, my apologies if I've stolen a phrase you've developed. This is a medical industrial complex. It is a perfect analogy to the military industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us against. the medical industrial complex, these industries work together. They try to solve the tensions among them so that they can put a common face to the rest of our society and say to us, you want a doctor, you need a hospital, you want some drugs, you want some insurance to cover it all, here we are. But we take care of each other first, and that's why you have to pay more for a medical attention than in any other developed country in the world. That's why you have the $3.5 trillion bill that you spoke so well about. It's the way capitalism works. It's the dream of most capitalists to capture their market. That's how they talk. To have the biggest possible market share. That's how they talk. And to become, in effect, a monopolist, someone who is so important in your field that you can manipulate the price, and because people don't have much choice, they'll have to give you the inflated price along the lines that you gave the illustrations. Again, my answer, and if I had more time, and maybe we can do another conversation in the future, Gary, if I had more time, I would give you more examples of how the way capitalism works confronts us, either as workers losing our jobs because profit takes our employer away, or overpaying for something as fundamental as our health once again because those employers have worked out a deal using this system's mechanisms to squeeze more out of us with each passing year. But my apologies, I have an enormous schedule of radio and television interviews, and my next one is in 4 minutes, and I have to go. I appreciate enormously your invitation and this conversation. And if we can continue it on another occasion, please know I would be very happy to do so.
We always look forward to having you on our program because you're a fountain of information. Thank you very much, Rich, for giving us, well, what amounts to 40 minutes of your time today. We'll look forward to
our next conversation. My pleasure, Gary. And thank you for producing the kinds of programs that allow this conversation, which is so needed, to become part of the public conversation in the country.
After reviewing the Great Reset's strategic initiatives, and these are all being developed by the World Economic Forum in partnership with org corporations and major international financial institutions and organizations like the Bill Gates Foundation, there's overwhelming preponderance and reliance upon technological solutions. This concerns me. This includes increasing investment and rollouts in automation, robotics, artificial intelligence, transhumanism technology, enormous data collection systems, digital medical monitoring, advanced surveillance, digital currency, 5G and satellites, and blockchain projects and investment. However, every one of these technologies goes right back to corporations and their large network of banks and investors. So this is still the same neoliberal capitalism, in my opinion, that has already brought us all of the failures of unregulated globalization. And unfortunately, it is supported fully by both parties. It was supported by Obama, by Trump, by Clinton, by Bush Sr., Jr., Gerald Ford, even Jimmy Carter, and certainly Ronald Reagan, who was one of the main architects of this. At the end of the day, the average person, struggling as they are today, are going to be really hurt, even worse, I believe, over the next couple of years than the first 10 months of what happened with the coronavirus pandemic and loss of jobs. Are we seeing the demise of the working class at the same time the proportional losses to the middle class, the working class, and now the professional class, because they're being automated out, are all being capitalized and brought to the enormous profits of Jeff Bezos and Berkshire Hathaway and these other major financial institutions?
Well, I think you've put your finger on what I would call sort of half the issue, and rightly so. The half issue is that this is a very old pattern of capitalism. It runs itself into difficulties, the sort of difficulties we're living through now, a major crash, as bad or worse than any we've had in the last century, happening together with a major public health failure and disaster, the coronavirus. Either of those would have been a challenge to our system. The two together in time and place is literally more than the system can handle, and we're seeing that being played out right now. When that has happened in the past, or anything like it, it has become extremely important for those who sit at the top of these societies to distract public upset, public anger, public bitterness, public anxiety by focusing on problems that are not the economic system and on solutions that do not challenge or change the economic system. And one of the most popular kinds of things is to focus on technology. So crises at the end of the 19th century, we were told, oh no, with electricity and modern chemistry and so forth, we'll have a new technological age and we won't have these problems. Fast forward a few decades and we were told it was atomic energy that was going to liberate the planet and we were all going to have a wonderful life in the future. Again, a few decades forward, and you have the computer, and now it's followers, robotics and artificial intelligence. Each time the story is the same, the new technology is going to be wonderfully productive and allow us to overcome the poverty, the inequality that the system keeps reproducing. So I could not agree with you more that this is the same old, with a slightly new package, a bunch of corporations wanting to show that they're concerned that capitalism is getting a bad reputation, which is the politest way of putting it, and they're going to revive, improve, reform, give capitalism a conscience, give capital, and I mean, it's endlessly, often recycling the very same phrases as how this is going to save us. It has never saved us, and you are exactly right, Gary. It hasn't saved us because all of these technologies, including those that genuinely have liberating capabilities, that could free us from arduous labor, from unnecessary labor, they're not doing that because they're being pursued, they're being developed, they're being installed by people who have a completely different objective from that. The objective of those that are making use of new technologies is to enhance profits. That's what they're there for. That's why they're interested in these things. They're not going to use them to give us, you know, a shorter work week. I mean, every major technological breakthrough probably of the last 200-300 years of capitalism has been touted by those who celebrate it as liberating us from arduous, unpleasant, mind-crushing labor. And what do the statistics show us? Americans are doing more hours of that kind of labor today than they did 30 years ago, 60 years ago, 100 years ago. The liberation keeps being promised, and it isn't delivered. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but let me remind you that for a very long time, varying religions in the world, not all of them, but varying ones, basically told the mass of people, yes, you're suffering, yes, it's terrible, but pretty soon you will die. And when you die, you're going to go to a place where you will never want for anything, where you will be deliriously happy, close to God, all of that, and just had to wait until you were dead. This is a kind of substitute. It's almost as though a technical revolution is some sort of magical equivalent of going to heaven and solving all of our problems. The only amazing thing for me is to see this game played yet again with a new package, the Great Reset, but it is a very old story.
We need to understand something, and you're certainly the oracle to help us on this. For many years, Klaus Schwab of the Economic Forum has advocated for replacing shareholder capitalism with what is called stakeholder capitalism. Almost a decade ago, he wrote about this in the New York Times essay. What is the difference between shareholder and stakeholder capitalism?
Very good. Let's unpack all of this. Shareholder capitalism, I assume, is understood by everyone listening, watching this program. But to be clear and certain, let's just remind. Most of the business of capitalism is done in corporations. That's the form. It's not the only form. There are self-employed people. There are partnerships. There are small businesses organized in a variety of ways. But the corporate form is the dominant form where most of the work in this society is done. All the large corporations, et cetera, are organized, almost all of them, as corporations. And when you have a corporation, it simply means that you have set up a business and that the money coming in to start the business, to build the business, is partly provided by people who buy shares in the stock market. That's what that market does, buy and sell shares that give you an ownership stake in the company, so that the owners once a year, the shareholders, have a vote. And in that vote, which happens once a year by law, they decide who's going to be on the board of directors, who's going to literally run the company for the next year. And you get one vote per share that you own. So if you own 1 million shares, you get 1 million votes. If you own 3 shares that your grandma left you, you get 3 votes. Why do I tell you this? 10% of the shareholders own 80% of the shares. In other words, the corporate core of the American capitalist system is owned by a tiny minority of the people who together are what we call the major shareholders. And they make the ultimate decisions. What the company produces, how it goes about doing it, what technology it uses, where it locates production, and perhaps the most important thing, what's going to be done with the profits that all the people working together have produced. These decisions are made by the tiny board of directors, by the way, typically 15, 20 people, who are elected each year by the shareholders, each one with a number of votes according to the number of shares he or she or it owns. So that's shareholder capitalism, a tiny group of people making decisions that shape all of our lives, literally. The goods and services we consume to reproduce ourselves, the conditions of our communities, the conditions of our larger society. Unbelievable for a society that calls itself democratic, that such a tiny minority, by the way, that is not accountable to anybody. We do not elect the people who are on the board of directors. The workers in an enterprise have no say over who their bosses are. You know, we vote for the mayor of our town or the congressperson. We have some influence over those who make decisions that shape our lives. But the minute we cross the threshold into a business, a factory, an office, a store, we give up democracy. We allow a tiny group of people to make all the decisions. What we do, how we do, where we do, whether we even have a job or not, is made by those people, and we simply have to live with it with no power. All right, this has been grotesque. It makes a mockery of the claim that we live in a democratic society. Let's remember that most adults in America today spend most of their adult life in the workplace, basically 5 days of the week. Basically, the big block of hours, you're either getting ready to go to work, or you're traveling to go to work, or you're at work, or you're coming back. But the best hours of the day, 5 out of 7 days, as an adult, you're at the workplace. So if you were really committed to democracy, it would have had to be installed at the workplace from the beginning, and it never was, not to this day. This is so bold a violation of the principle of democracy that we're supposedly committed to, that people have come up with all kinds of excuses and halfway measures and apologies to try to get around this contradiction. One of them is called stakeholder capitalism. Here's how it works. Such people, like Schwab and others, admit that there's something wrong here, that because other people have a very strong stake in what the company or the corporation does, they ought to have some power. It shouldn't all be in the hands of the moneyed people who bought the shares, but it belongs, for example, in the workers whose job and livelihood, as well as that of their families, depends on it. It belongs in the community where the business is located, because it depends on the taxes the company pays, on the way it conducts its business. In other words, all kinds of parts of our society have a stake in what corporations do, and they ought to have some say in it. So there are various proposals then how you might give the larger community, the labor force, the customers of a corporation some kind of role to play, some kind of power to wield. And there are literally hundreds of variations on this. By the way, in some countries, this principle, capitalist countries I'm talking about, this principle has been taken much further than in the United States. So let me give you an example from Germany. In Germany, there is a principle that has been enacted into law. In German, it's called Mitbestimmung. That translates into English codetermination. What does it mean? Well, here's one of the provisions of the law. Every corporation in Germany that has 2,000 or more workers has to give at least 40 or 45% of the seats on the board of directors to individuals who are workers and were elected to that position by the other workers. In other words, the board of directors of any sizable German company has workers on it. And that has been the case for decades. Even if you're smaller than 2,000, I believe the percentage is 30% at least, have to be worker-elected, worker representatives to give them as stakeholders some kind of vote, making decisions. They are not a majority. The majority is still the shareholders, because anyone that has talked about stakeholders has usually only talked about giving others than the shareholders some say over what's going on, but never the dominant say, never the majority position, none of that. So think of it as a kind of partial, halfway recognition that having a tiny minority of our people dominating our corporations and making all the decisions is a flat-out contradiction with democracy, for which there is no reasonable excuse.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you very much. We're out of time. Richard Wolff, Professor Richard Wolff, outstanding in his economic philosophy and concepts, and what's important in our society where we believe in freedom of choice. He represents a voice for the people, and that's important. Richard, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate the opportunity, and I thank you for having these kinds of conversations so that the kind of information and thinking that we need to spread in this country gets a chance to be heard so that folks can consider it.
Professor Richard Wolff, my guest. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
There's too many of you crying. brother, brother, brother. There's far too many of you dying.